From the Carter Subaru Studios, this is Cairo Nights with Jake Skorheim.
Welcome to Cairo Nights. Thank you guys so much for joining us. I am Jake Skorheim, your host. We've got a great show for you tonight. I hope you had a wonderful weekend. I hope you just had a great time. The weather was beautiful. I got a ton of stuff done. I didn't plan on doing this. I don't know if you guys experienced anything similar, but I was fortunate enough that my wife had a wonderfully long list of things for me to do in the yard, which was so fun. Like, I didn't know that I was going to plant 12 trees this weekend, but guess what I got to do? I got to plant trees, but happy wife, happy life. All right, it's Mondays. I love Mondays. They're the best.
Behold, a fiendish masterpiece from the bowels of hell. Yeah. Mondays, boy, I hate Mondays. They make me so steamed. Weekends,
I'm for the weekends.
Son of a...
All right, so I hope you guys had a wonderful weekend. I really do. This weekend, as I mentioned just a second ago, I spent a great deal of time, like a great, great deal of time, moving trees, planting trees, doing all sorts of stuff. And, you know, it's nice. It's to beautify the yard. The first really, I don't know, it just really felt like almost a summery weekend. I think it got up to 70 degrees at one point. We got some nice weather coming at us. Today's not too nice. It's like super rainy and wet. But today, or earlier today was. And now we have this beautiful weather coming in. So I'm planting all these trees this weekend. And my wife, this is, I don't know, she's pregnant. So I'm trying to like give her a lot of leeway and a lot of grace because she's changing her mind a lot of things. I think they call this nesting. Do you guys know about this? They call this nesting. And that's what my wife tells me, at least. Basically, she just is changing her mind all the time and coming up with long lists of things that she wants me to do. And then I do those things, and then they're not quite exactly the way that she envisioned them. And so I get to do those things, like, I don't know, like sometimes a second and a third time. And it's really great because, like, you know, if your job, once you get married, if you can look at marriage as, all right, how do I put this other person first? How do I constantly try to make their life better? And if they're doing that for you too, then you're both feeling all the time like somebody's investing time into you. It's a real warm, cuddly feeling. So it's great. So this weekend, I think my wife felt very warm and cuddly because I was spending a lot of time, you know, just doing stuff that she wanted done. And she felt like if it doesn't get done now, then it'll never get done. And I think, again, it was baby related. She said it was nesting stuff. And I was like, I don't know. I don't know how like planting all these trees is going to help us have a better baby experience. But that's what she tells me. So I was moving this one tree. I'm not kidding you. This thing was in my yard. We had planted it 2 years ago. It was a big tree. I actually got it from Big Trees in Snohomish. Fantastic tree. That's not a plug for them. I'm just telling you, they have great trees. So I went down there. I get this big, beautiful tree. We plant it in the yard. We love it. It's got this beautiful fall foliage. It just like explodes into oranges and yellows right outside our living room window and in the fall. And it's gorgeous. We love it. But my wife, she was like, you know what? I think I would rather have this tree over there on the other side of the yard. I'm like, all right, are you serious? Or is this like kind of just one of those things that you wish, but you don't really want to see me do? And she goes, no, I think I want to see you do it. So I moved the tree. I'm going to get through the story really fast, but I had nobody else to tell the story to because nobody else cares. So I want to tell you guys because I need some sympathy and my back needs some sympathy. And I'm taking a lot of Advil right now. So I dig the tree up, which takes, I don't know, like 45 minutes, an hour. I'm a quick digger. So I dig, I lift, I can barely lift this thing because just the base, just the root system probably weighs 200 pounds. I don't know how I did it, just like muscle man strength. I think when your wife stares at you long enough, you just like get the ability to do things. And so I lift this thing into the wheelbarrow, I move it across the yard, I plant it into another previously dug hole that I had, you know, prepared. I drop it in there, I replant it, I get all the fresh soil on top of it, do all the stuff, you know, I water it and put all the compost or whatever you're supposed to do. There's a lot of stuff you're supposed to do. I then do these things. Mind you, the entire time she is out, I'm not expecting her to do anything because she's 7.5 months pregnant. There's just literally nothing she can do except tell me what to do. And that is how we are a team right now. And so she's telling me what to do and I move the tree and then it looks great. And I'm super satisfied with it. And I think it looks great. And she thinks it looks great. And so she pats me on the back. Jake, you did a great job. Oh, thank you, sweetie, so much. It's nothing. I'm like playing it off like my back isn't about to break in half. We go inside and she looks out the, where she can see it out the window. And she looks up at the tree and she goes, I think maybe we put it in the wrong spot. And I'm like, no, I don't think so. I don't think that's what you're thinking. You're probably thinking something else. She goes, no, I think we did put it in the wrong spot. I'm like, I don't know. Maybe let's give it a few days. See how it grows. You know, these trees go into shock when you move them sometimes. It'll look better once it has a chance to fill out. And she goes, no, I think it needs to be like 7 inches to the left. And I was like, you have got to be kidding me. Branches grow. This thing will be fine. Give it 2 months. You won't even notice. And she goes, I'm nesting. It really needs it right now. And so I said, all right. So that's what I spent all day Sunday doing, was then moving this tree 7 inches to the left. We finally got it just right. And again, she's very happy with it right now. So I guess that means we all feel good about it. But if you had any time doing anything like that over the weekend, I'd love to find out. We can commiserate in our pain from doing our yard work. But it was a beautiful weekend. It was nice to get out there. And now I got a big, beautiful tree, like right where my wife wants it, which is great. All right, let's get into some news stories. This one was a really interesting story, and I was caught off guard by the I saw the headline. I went, yeah, this makes total sense. So Jason Rantz, who's a great friend of the show, he's a good buddy of mine in real life, he often comes on the show, but he has a his own show over on our sister station, 770 KTTH. Jason Rantz has this really interesting article, and it's the kind of thing that you kind of suspect is what's happening, but when you can actually see some stats on it, I guess they call that confirmation bias. It makes you feel better that you already knew something. All right, so here's what the headline is. The headline says, homeless addicts, the real reason for Seattle Public Library closures. I'm going to read you a little bit of this article. You can check it out yourself on mynorthwest.com. We're actually going to talk to Jason about this in just a little while. I think this is a really big issue and something that, you know, as a parent, I go to the Listen, I love the library. I love it. I love it with my kids. When I was a kid, I remember like that first, you all remember this, like the first sense of independence that you feel as a child for many of us, like all these great moments where we starting to feel like, you know, just a little bit more grown up, like a big kid. A lot of those happened at the library. Like I have a couple, like just very clear moments at the library when I was a kid. One of them, I get my first library card and my mom is explaining to me that like, yeah, now you can kind of check out books on your own. And I was so excited that I had the authority to go in there and look up, you know, like Berenstain Bear books or whatever I was reading at the time, like Boxcar Children. I read a lot of Chronicles of Narnia books. It was just cool to have a card that was mine because you always see parents walking around with these cards. Like the first time I got my own bank account, like I remember when Washington Mutual, you guys remember that bank when that was around? I remember getting my first bank book with Washington Mutual when I was probably 10 years old. Maybe 11 or 12. I don't remember the exact age, but it was like I was very young. I think I had $25 to put in it, but it was an official book. It had my name on it. I think it was maybe connected to my dad's account, but whatever. It had my name on it. I went in there and my dad was introducing me to finances. And it was so cool that I got to go into the bank. I know I've switched over to the bank store, but I'll get back to the library in a second. But I got to go into the bank. And I got to have my little bank book and I got to sit there and at home, I remember like keeping it in the top drawer of my dresser and I would go and I would check it from time to time. Like, I don't know what I was expecting. It's not updating. This is like 30 years ago. Like the book was not changing. That technology did not exist back then and doesn't now. And so I would, you know, and then I would get excited. I would, when I had like a couple of bucks from mowing lawns or whatever it was, if I had any left over from like stupid things, like candy that I would buy, I would then put it into the bank and you get to watch that climb up. And it's just, it's introducing you to a world outside of kiddom. And the library was very much that place as well. For me, when I was a kid, I remember checking out books and being so excited because I'd get up to the front and the librarian would, you know, adorably check my books out for me. I don't remember if they had scanning back then. They probably didn't have scanning 30 years ago when I got my first library card. They probably literally were doing the, you know, chunk stamp thing. And that was great. Another seminal library moment that I have in my life. I don't remember the exact age, but I think I was around 5 years old. I'm at the library. It's in Everett, Washington. My mom and I, my sister was in school. My mom had just me. And your parents doing what they do with their kids when they're just filling time. You know, you take your kids to the library, you go to a library reading group, which I did with my kids all of the time. My wife used to take all my kids to the library reading groups. It was fantastic. So we would go. So I'm 5 years old. I have this core, it's a core memory. That's what they're called. It's a core memory. I'm in the library. It's dark. We walk down these steps and we turn the corner. And I'm like, what are we doing here, Mom? Like, this is not like the well-lit library area. And we walk in and they have set up a movie. And like, my family did not have a lot of money when we were growing up. So we didn't spend a lot of time going out and going to the movies and things like that. So to go to the library, to have a big projection screen set up, which they did, and they were playing Fox and the Hound. And I remember walking up, my mom and I sat down in these two metal chairs, you know, the library just like put out some folding chairs. And we sat there and I watched the Fox and the Hound sitting with my mom, holding my mom's hand. And it was one of those memories that I'm going to have for the rest of my life. I'm like getting almost emotional talking about it, just thinking about my mom. She's still with us, thank God. love you, Mom. But the library can be a really magical place, like a really, really great place for families, for, you know, adults who don't have kids too. It's a, you know, great place for research. You can go in there and get some work done. But for me, the thing that I really associate libraries with is when you are a child going there with your parents. And I think that's a really, really cool space. And so I'm a big supporter of libraries. What happens at libraries, though, in Seattle right now, Seattle public libraries are having these closures. Jason Rance has this article. Listen to this. The Seattle Public Library closures announcement means branches are dark one day a week. But the decision has been shrouded in misinformation and a lack of transparency. While local media and politicians cite a staffing crisis that ostensibly began in 2008, the truth actually tells a different story. And then Jason looks into this a little bit. And what he says is SPL's intermittent closures set to continue through at least June are not due to a genuine staffing shortfall. This is Jason Rance's article. In fact, Seattle Library staff numbers have grown since 2019 before the pandemic. The real issue, Jason says, is the libraries have become battlegrounds for the city's housing and drug crises, necessitating increased safety for staff, not service. I'm sorry, increased staff for safety, not service. Seattle libraries have shifted from being just about books to dealing with the fallout of these crises. Drug-addicted and mentally ill homeless individuals have escalated emergencies across library branches, creating an environment where safety concerns are dictating too many operational decisions. And then he gets into kind of the nitty-gritty, and he talks about how many incidents the libraries in Seattle are seeing with people who are either homeless or mentally ill or have drug-related issues coming into these open libraries, which, like I said a second ago, was a really cool space for families. And definitely families know, like you guys know, if you're listening to this right now and you go to libraries, you also know the libraries that you don't want to take your kids to. And that's a bummer because libraries are community, wonderful spaces. And they're places where people and moms and dads should feel very comfortable bringing their little kids. But like, I definitely know there's certain libraries downtown. I wouldn't bring my kids, not in a million years. I don't want them to see the kind of stuff that they would see there. All right, so listen to this. When something disruptive occurs, such as a police incident nearby or a drug smoking attempt in a restroom, those kinds of activities require additional staff on site to coordinate the appropriate response. This is what a Seattle Library spokesperson told Jason on his show on KTTH. The library saw close to 400 such incidents in 2023. 400. That's more than one a day, last time I checked the calendar, affecting both staff and patrons. Because of failures in Seattle, drug-addicted, mentally ill, homeless have created an emergency at various Seattle library branches, and the threats they pose are trending upward. As of this year, Seattle Public Libraries has already encountered over 100 incidents. Again, this is from the library spokesperson, who says having more staff on site helps make those interactions a bit easier, as we also work to provide a full suite of library services. So, you know, what really sucks here, that was a spokesperson talking to Jason Rancho. What sucks is that the library is having to now prioritize health and safety instead of helping people pick out books or doing readings for kids or doing cool community events. I understand that there's homeless people and I understand that there's mentally ill people and I understand that those people need help. I get it 100%. But it's now costing you the ability to go to the library. They're going to have these blackout dates where they just don't have the staff to keep it open for you. because their staff is being used in other areas now. Jason's going to talk to us about this in a little bit. He's got some other details here in this article that I haven't even had a chance to get into yet with you. It is fascinating. It's kind of frightening. It's kind of sad. But is there a fix? Is there a way that we can fix this problem? Yes, I'm hopeful that there is. So I want to talk about that with Jason, too, in just a little bit. All right, really fast. I want to get to this before we run out of time. I found this fascinating. The O.J. Bronco. Do you remember O.J. Simpson? Of course you guys do. He just passed away at the end of last week. He died at 76 of cancer. Now, O.J. was really, really famous for playing football. And he was in a bunch of TV commercials. He was also in a bunch of movies. He was infamous, though, when he was put on trial for the murder of his ex-wife and her friend. He was acquitted, and he was found not guilty.
All right, Mr. Simpson, would you please stand and face the jury? Mrs. Robertson.
Superior Court of California, County of Los Angeles, in the matter of the people of the state of California versus Orenthal James Simpson, case number BA-097-211. We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant Orenthal James Simpson not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of Penal Code Section 187A, a felony upon Nicole Brown Simpson.
All right, so OJ was found not guilty of murder. And you might remember just before he went on trial, he was a suspect and he was supposed to turn himself in. And instead of turning himself in as was planned, he kind of went on a run. And it was seen everywhere. You guys, of course, have seen the white Bronco. You know the video I'm talking about, him driving down I-5 with all those police, all those LAPD officers following him as he slowly made his way with his buddy Al Cowlings back to his house, I believe in Brentwood.
I'm going to have to interrupt this call. I understand we're going to go to a live picture in Los Angeles. Is that correct? Okay. This is Interstate 5, and this is courtesy of KCALR, one of our L.A. affiliates. Police believe that O.J. Simpson is in that car.
All right, so that was Larry King Live. He was breaking into his segment to report that O.J. Simpson was in that car. The entire world was captivated by it. People were actually like running over. It was such big news, and people knew about it, which is amazing when you think about this. This is back in the early 90s, before they had social media, before everyone was really using cell phones. I mean, they had cell phones, but they weren't ubiquitous in everybody's pocket like they are now. The spread of information happened on radio and TV only. And people still figured out that OJ was going to be coming up on I-5 soon. And they would literally like stop their cars in traffic so they could get out of their cars and watch OJ drive in this white Bronco. So this white Bronco became really, really famous and then kind of disappeared. And for a couple of decades, it sat in a parking garage. Then it was purchased by Simpson's former agent, a guy named Michael Gilbert, and three other people. They bought it from Cowlings and have held on to it since. Well, now the vehicle is going to go possibly up for auction just after OJ's passing. This would be the time. Michael Gilbert was talking. I believe this was in the Daily Mail. But he said, before OJ passed, we had always thought that this was going to be the year that we were going to sell because it's the 30th anniversary. Who knows if we were all going to be around for the 35th or the 40th. He and the two other owners of the car, of the Bronco, say that they're expecting to get $1.5 million from either a public or a private sale. So who knows if they're going to get it. Would you guys buy a Bronco that was owned by O.J. Simpson? I guess it wasn't owned by O.J. Simpson. I'm sorry. It was owned by Al Cowlings. O.J. drove in the car. So yeah, maybe you could own the Bronco, especially if it's worth $1.5 million. It's a pretty good deal. All right. We got Jason Rantz coming on with us next. Hang around for that. We're going to be right back here on Cairo Nights.
You're listening to Cairo Nights with Jake Skorheim.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. I have a very special guest on with me right now, Jason Rantz from the Jason Rantz Show over on 770 KTTH. Also, he's got a good book. It actually relates to this topic, so you guys should read it. It's called What's Killing America. Get it on Amazon. Jason Rantz, welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show indeed.
Okay, you have a really good article on MyNorthWest.com, as you do often, most days.
Every day.
Yeah, every day. It's usually the number one story, well-read.
Every day.
Every single day. I'm just pump you up a little. I don't need to pump you up. You're getting good ratings. So this story I thought was really interesting because it kind of confirms something that I just saw happening all the time, but now with actual data, and now with actual facts behind it that I can tell other people, it's just nice to have. Seattle Library has something going on right now called, what are these, are blackout dates?
Well, they're simply calling them intermittent closure. So one day a week at almost all the branches, although not all branches, will be closed. And
at the Seattle Public Libraries.
All Seattle Public Libraries at some point will have a day a week that they will be closed because of a lack of staff. And if you read any of the reporting or heard any of it or watched any of it, it was all about they don't have enough staff members.
Yeah, they're understaffed. There's just not enough people to check out books.
Which is odd because their staffing is actually higher now than it was in 2019.
That is odd.
So we kind of already knew that was bogus. And it took me one email to find out what was going on. And I already knew. They have a homeless issue. They have a bunch of homeless people who are going into the libraries, primarily downtown, but not exclusively. They are causing all sorts of issues. And as a result of the security concerns, the Seattle Public Library System decided to increase the minimum staffing numbers because it was too dangerous under the previous staffing numbers. So when they say it's a quote-unquote staffing issue, well, kind of, but it wouldn't be a staffing issue if you didn't have the homelessness crisis.
Yes. And so one interesting thing that jumped out at me in the article is how many incidents we're seeing. So in 2023, how many incidents was there?
400, a little over four.
400. Last time I checked a calendar, that's more than one per day.
Yeah.
Where somebody's doing something that it rises to the level where police have to be called.
Police have to be called.
So this could be drugs on the premises. This could be smoking in the bathroom,
Someone having a drug. Mental health issue.
Somebody having a mental health issue. Somebody overdosing. Yep. Another thing that they started encouraging.
I think that's fair.
So another thing they started letting their public library employees do was carrying Narcan.
Mm-hmm.
And why would you need an employee to carry Narcan around?
You have so many overdoses that they wanted to do something about it. I say in my piece that this is a problem that it invited on itself because you had a bunch of librarians who are very far to the left who are actively trying to turn these places into day shelters, which is what they have effectively become. The problem, of course, is, it's not really safe. They hired some social services librarians whose jobs it is to basically work with the homeless to connect them with resources either at the city level or the county level.
Somebody who might spend a chunk of your day helping somebody find a Judy Blume book and the other half of your day counseling somebody who's going through a drug-related crisis and how to get the kind of help that they need from the county. That's a lot to ask from somebody who's checking out books.
Well, they are asking for it, though. That's the thing. I mean, they want probably not all the staff members, but these staff members have been asking for those kinds of resources and that kind of job. And at the same time, as of Friday of last week, there have been a little over 100 incidents that were...
Yow.
Yeah, exactly. And so that puts us on track to at least hit, but probably exceed last year's high number.
You know the really depressing part about that? I mean, there's many depressing parts about this. But when I was reading this article, I was taken back to my experience as a kid going to the library.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a kid, I have this core memory, and I talked about this just a little bit ago on the show, but I have this core memory in my head of when I went to the library with my mom up in Everett before libraries got, dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And, my wife, still, I have three young kids. She's pregnant with our fourth kid. There has always been a time in life. It's usually from about 1.5 to, three-ish, 3.5 to 4, when they're starting to get into preschool and then they're eventually off to kindergarten, where you're just looking for things to do during the day to fill that time. Because my wife, she's a, full-time mom. And so usually, at least once or twice a week, she's taking the kids, whichever kid is still at home, to these library reading times where they would have,
drag queens.
Well, no, they're not having those, but they're having, certain libraries are, but those weren't the ones. But we were attending, just kid story time where they would, read little kids' books, or they would have somebody come in and do, an arts and crafts thing or whatever, simple kid-themed things, little kid things. That was such a cool experience for her. And I know something that we're going to look back on. I've gone to many of these with my wife and kids. we're going to look back on those experiences and go like, oh, weren't those great memories?
Mm-hmm. Those were the days.
Those were the days. And then when I was a kid, I remember going down to the Everett Library. My mom took, you know, we didn't have a ton of money when I was a kid. And so we didn't go to see movies a lot. But one day, I'm 5 years old, she walks me, we go to the library and we go downstairs to this other room. And there is a big giant, they've set up a little movie theater, like an impromptu movie theater. They have a screen. They're playing Fox and the Hound. I remember sitting there next to my mom watching Fox and the Hound. These are all wonderful library experiences. Are those experiences still happening for people anymore, or is it just like drug-related things? And
my guess is Seattle, the answer is no. You might be able to find that in maybe in parts of Snohomish County.
Yeah. Like, well, I mean, I know it still exists because my wife still goes to these things, but they're not worried about like, oh, is this person going to be able to help us with Narcan?
In Seattle, it just doesn't exist. So I went down to the downtown Seattle library this weekend.
Did you wear your flak jacket?
So here's the funny thing. The second I walk in, I hear a guy going, yeah, yeah, just like making this weird squeal. And as someone who's dealing with a mental health issue, walking out, I saw as I was going
in. He actually runs the place? No, just kidding.
Probably.
Just joking.
As I was walking in, you have that going in one direction. Then the other direction, I saw security moving people out who were very clearly homeless. Then you get to the top floor, the second floor. And
is this the big glass one?
The big glass one that's like pyramid-y.
Yeah.
It's just filled with homeless people who are just sleeping, passed out. And, you know, at the end of the day, if you're literally not doing anything, I don't care, I guess.
Sure.
But it does start to smell. And we can pretend otherwise. People don't want to admit that. It's true.
Yeah.
It's not really a great experience if you're going into this library and it just smells because there's some people there. And, you know, not everyone is like that. But,
you know,
it is an issue that people just downplay, but it matters.
I guess, you know, the interesting thing about it is like, you know, libraries are kind of, unfortunately or fortunately in some cases, they're kind of reflections of the community in which they're they're based. And so the ones that my family and I choose to go in, they're pretty delightful and they're nice and they're still very family oriented. Or if somebody wants to go in there and get a little bit of work done or maybe some research for a school paper or something, that's happening in certain areas. But there are other places where, like, I would never bring my kids to a downtown library because I'd be kind of nervous about what I would see them experience.
I will say, I felt weird about it. I did go into the computer section to see if there was watching pornography.
A lot of blacked out screens.
I was just waiting, and I didn't see it, but I didn't go all the way to the other end because I got bored, frankly, and I left.
Well, people have a lot of other ways to watch porn these days. They can just watch it on their
phones. There's always that one
There's
person.
Always one. No, you're totally right.
Always
because
one.
Because what they want to do, they don't just want to watch it. They
want
to watch
it you to
near
watch
other
it.
People.
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's a weird place.
Pervs.
All right. That's Jason Rance. Get out of here, you person. Check him out on the Jason Rance Show, 770 KTTH. Check him out on the sites, all over the site. It's good stuff. Thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We're going to be right back here on Cairo Nights.
You're listening to Cairo Nights with Jake Skorheim.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. Listen to this. This is crazy. I'm not trying to freak you guys out, but I want you very carefully. Like, if you're listening in your car, maybe don't do this right now because it is scary. And I don't want you to be scared. And just drive comfortably ahead. Stare straight ahead. Don't be scared. Don't do anything drastic. But I need you guys to know something. For the rest of you who aren't driving around, I want you to go outside. Or look to your window. It's kind of cold, so maybe don't go outside. But look to your window right now. Look up at the moon. Can you see it? Well, I have bad news for you. The moon is shrinking. Can you guys believe that? The moon is shrinking. According to a new study, the moon is shrinking. And NASA flights could actually be affected. So some folks over at the University of Maryland, some researchers were looking into this. And they found that the moon's core, because it was made of molten something, I guess, is cooling. And as it cools, the surface of the moon, which is brittle, starts to contract. And when it contracts and gets smaller, according to researchers, again, at University of Maryland, I don't know a ton about science and the moon and the stars, but as it contracts, the surface becomes more vulnerable, which could then lead to, you guessed it, earthquakes, which could cause landslides, which also could endanger future astronauts, which is kind of crazy. So not only is the moon's surface shrinking, it's also more dangerous when we're there. And we're about to send more astronauts there, which is nuts. Listen to this. This is from a researcher at the University of Maryland. As we get closer to the crewed Artemis mission launch date, it's important to keep our astronauts, our equipment, and infrastructure as safe as possible. Nicholas Schmer, a geologist at the University of Maryland who helped author the study, stated, he said, this work is helping us prepare for what awaits us on the moon, whether that's engineering structures that can be better withstand lunar seismic activity or protecting people from really dangerous zones. All good things to know. All great things to know. It reminds me of this song. Do you guys remember this song, R.E.M.? Such a great song. Do you guys believe that, by the way? Do you believe they put a man on the moon? There's a lot of people who don't. I watched this, I can't remember where it was, but I think it was a, I don't know, some sort of a documentary, one of those things. And they were lining up. This is all ridiculous. I'm sure that, I'm like 99% sure there's a printed person on the moon, but 1% of me goes, I don't know, it seems pretty tough for 1960s. So what they did was they looked at all these images on that they had taken over various trips to the moon, you know, quote unquote trips to the moon, you know, I don't know. And they have those little crosshairs in those old pictures. I have these little crosshairs in the corner. And one of those was behind. And I guess there was like some stuff, some foreground material, or some material in the foreground, which shouldn't have been like that. And so they were trying to, I guess they were trying to suggest these pictures were fake. There's actually a really interesting movie. I can't remember the name of it right now. You guys might remember it. Hit me up on the text line if you do, although it's late in the show, so I may not read it at this point. But there was a movie, and I'm trying to remember what it was. O.J. Simpson was in it. Oh my gosh, Gemini something. What was it? Anyway, it was about the faked moon landing. And I remember seeing that as a kid and thinking, wow, is this what happened? And also I thought, wow, is that O.J.? That's crazy. And indeed, it was O.J., and I'm trying to remember the name of it, Gemini something. But a lot of people don't believe it happened, but I believe it happened. I think it most likely happened. So NASA plans to launch Artemis 3 in 2026, which would be the first time that they have sent a man or woman to the moon in over half a century. The last time there was a person on the moon was Apollo 17. It landed on the moon December 11th, 1972, which is really just a long time ago. Very fascinating. I was also fascinated by that song. I just played a clip from really fast. That was R.E.M. That's Michael Stipe, who's the lead singer of R.E.M. talking or singing Man on the Moon, which was in the movie Man on the Moon, I believe, which was the Andy Kaufman story, starring Jim Carrey, who was totally in character as Andy Kaufman and was apparently very bizarre on set and maybe even a little off-putting to folks because he was like channeling Andy Kaufman, totally method in that role. But Michael Stipe was on Smartless the other day, which is a fantastic podcast. He was talking about his process for writing the song Man on the Moon. And I found this fascinating. And there's a connection to Seattle because he wrote it in Seattle. I'll let him tell you about it.
The band scored a film called Man on the Moon with Milos Forman.
Oh, right.
Oh, sure.
Based on a song that we wrote called Man on the Moon, which was about Andy Kaufman.
Yeah.
And the comedian. And it kind of brought Andy back into as he had died and had kind of been forgotten, and this friend of ours brought some VHS tapes to a studio in Seattle, and we were there working, and I watched the tapes, and then there was this piece of music that the band loved, but I couldn't find it, and I went on a long walk the last day that we were in the studio, and I wrote Man on the Moon walking around the blocks of downtown Seattle and recorded it that night, and we gave it to the record company the next day, and that was that.
No.
It's crazy. I mean, that really happened. That's super nuts.
Isn't that so cool? It's just like, couldn't find the song, and finally he writes a song in one walk through Seattle because it's such an inspirational city, or was once upon a time.